some type of seminar, you're given information. You're given perhaps a syllabus or something that explains, you know, all the things that you're going to be exposed to, the scope of the course, where it's going. But, you know, there's one thing in particular that most students are specifically looking for. And if it's not clearly laid out, it will be among the very first questions. And that is, what are we going to be graded on? What's the standard for grading? How is this going to be measured? You know, you would think that if we're taking a class, the thing that would interest us the most is, what are we going to learn? What are we going to expose to? You know, how is this going to change my life? But we tend to go toward what's going to be required of me. And you know, that's not just about academics. That's about how people react to other things, such as commandments, such as their relationship with God. For instance, and if you have your Bibles, you can look with me to Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10. And in Luke chapter 10, we find the account of what we often refer to as the Good Samaritan. And it begins in verse 25. In Luke chapter 10, in verse 25, it says, "And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and put him," that is Jesus, "to the test, saying, 'Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?' And Jesus responds in verse 26 and says, 'What is written in the law? How does it read to you?'" So this guy's asking Jesus, "What's required of me?" And Jesus says, "Well, you know, you have the equivalent of what we call, you know, you have a Bible. You've read the Bible. What do you understand it to say?" So in 27, the guy responds, says, "Well, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and you and all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." Well, so this guy is, you know, he's very knowledgeable, both of what we refer to as the Old Testament. He's also very knowledgeable of the debate that are going on at that time period in the rabbinic circles, for it was being argued what's, you know, the greatest commandments, how do you rank them, and these kinds of things. And he gave a good summary there. And Jesus is somewhat impressed. And going in, he says, "Well, you've answered correctly. Do this and you will live." And so the guy in 29, it says, wishing to justify himself, he says, "Who's my neighbor?" That is, what's required of me to pass this test? Now, when you look at the command, love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. You know, you could choose to focus on various things if you wanted to, you know, kind of break that apart. You know, your focus could be, okay, love. How do I understand love? What does it mean to love? Or you could look at neighbor. Well, if you're wanting to limit it, if you're wanting to say, okay, I've got to keep this commandment, but I want to keep this commandment in a way that I can keep this commandment. That is, I want to approach this course in a way that I can make an A. Well, the best way to do it is to define neighbor in a way that enables me to keep it. And that's what was currently going on. Neighbor becomes someone I can define. So, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, it just so happens that the only one in the world that's my neighbor is Robin. And so as long as I love Robin, I'm keeping this commandment. Or maybe neighbor is those that I go to church with. Or maybe neighbor is those that happen to be from Texas. You know, you define neighbor. And so that's what they're doing. You put it in these certain categories. Things are likewise. And so Jesus responds with this parable, this story of the Good Samaritan. And to make this a little more contemporary, we'll change the setting somewhat and we'll retell it, trying not to do too much injustice to the passage and to God's Word. But you're on your way to Oklahoma City. And as you're driving down the interstate, you pull over at a roadside park. And you've got your family with you, and as you pull up, you're starting to get out, but you notice that kind of on that kind of a hillside, kind of a little bit out of sight there, there's a guy laying there. He looks in bad shape. And you're kind of, I don't know. I don't even know if I want to get out. This guy, this is probably somebody, at best he's drunk. And most likely, this is somebody on drugs. I don't know, it kind of looks like he's beat up. Well, he was probably beat up because he was selling drugs. I'm in a dead zone. I'll just drive on to Oklahoma City. When I get close enough where my cell phone picks up again, I'll call 911. Well, you go on your way, but then comes along, Bob Marburger, one of the elders of the church, and Bob does exactly the same thing. Well, then along comes this Arab guy. He sees this white guy out there. He goes over and he looks at him and he says, somebody beat this guy up. And he gets him, puts him in his car, takes him to Oklahoma City, takes him to the hospital. He says, I don't know if the guy has insurance. I don't know anything about this guy, but you just take care of him and here's my credit card. Put whatever you need on this. Well, he finishes the story. We're back in Luke, in verse 20 or 36, and Jesus says, which of these do you think proved to be a neighbor? Do you notice the difference between what the guy asked and what Jesus answered? The guy asked the question, who is my neighbor? That is, I want you to define it in terms of who do I have to love? I can keep this command if you'll just give me some parameters. If you'll tell me who it is I have to love. But Jesus answers the question and he says, who proved to be the neighbor? It's one of focus. It's one of perspective. When you read the command, love your neighbor as yourself, you can ask yourself the question, okay, God tells me to love my neighbors. Okay, let me see if I can figure out who a neighbor is. Or you can read that and say, I'm to love my neighbor. Therefore, I'm to love people. Therefore, who am I going to prove? Who am I going to be a neighbor to? Well, the man understands the question, the statement from Jesus, and he says, the one who showed mercy. The one that cared. The one that did something. And Jesus says, go and do the same. The test of love. We've been looking in 1 John. And last week we mentioned that there are some tests in 1 John. There's the obedient test or the morality test. And we looked last week in the sense that God says, keep my commands. And this issue of fellowship, this issue of intimacy of God is connected with being obedient. Well, a second test is this test of love. Test of love. To be in fellowship with God, to have that deep personal relationship with God, to walk with God in that regard, is to be a person that loves. All we saw before that same context of fellowship is tied with the way we deal with sin. That our goal needs to be not to sin, but if we do or when we do sin, that we confess our sins. And fellowship in that regard is connected in that first part. Well, in 1 John chapter 2, as we look at this passage, this morning we see that it's about test. It's about test. But the test in view here is the test of love. And many of us have heard at some point in our Christian lives, as we've been exposed to teachings and stuff, we've heard that fellowship, this aspect of being filled with the Spirit, this connection between fellowship and the filling of the Spirit, that there's a direct connection with it in 1 John 1:9 of confessing sins. Now, if you look at the Ephesians 5:18 passage about being filled with the Spirit, and you'll try to understand the context of it, and you look at 1 John 1:9, there's no direct connection between those passages. There's nothing to directly draw you from that passage to this passage. But the 1 John passage is speaking about fellowship. And that's somewhat of a connection. But it is curious to me why I've heard it emphasized so that this filling of the Spirit, this fellowship, is so dependent upon confessing of sins in 1 John 1:9. But I've never heard it explained that it's dependent upon keeping the commandments, 1 John 2:3, or in love, in the passage we're talking about. They're all in the same context. They're probably all aspects of that. For in 1 John, they're all aspects of fellowship. In 1 John, as we'll look, this test is, in my belief, my understanding of not only this passage, but of Scripture, it's not a test of, are you a Christian? It's not a test of, oh, I see that guy's not a Christian. It has to do with intimacy with God, fellowship, relationship, consistency in walk with God. So let's look at this passage. In 1 John chapter 2 and verse 7, it says, "Beloved, I am not writing a new commandment to you, but an old commandment which you have had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word which you have heard." Well, then our first point, we could say, the commandment is old because it is the message you have heard since becoming a Christian. It's an old commandment, John is saying. Now, in the context, as we get to verses 9 and 11, we will see that the commandment clearly refers to loving one another. Now, in the previous verses, he's talked about keeping commands. Now, he's singled out one command, but the specific commandment he's talking about is to love one another. And that will become, like I said, clear when we look at 9 and 11. But the commandment here is to love one another. It should be, he says, it shouldn't be viewed as new. That is, new in the sense that there's a new responsibility, a new content. There's nothing new about it, John is saying. The commandment is to love one another. And in that sense, it should be viewed as an old commandment because it's what you received in the beginning. Not the beginning of time, but the beginning of the relationship with Jesus Christ. When they heard the gospel, when the gospel was preached to this group, one of the things they heard, that Christianity is about loving one another. So as long as they've been a Christian, as long as the gospel message is in this community, as long as they've been hearing about Jesus Christ, it's been a part of that, that we are to love one another. And John says, this is the old commandment. It's as old as your beliefs are. There's nothing new about it. There's nothing revolutionary about it in that regard. Remember when there was just Coke, and then somebody decided we needed new Coke, and when that person was fired, they decided, how do you get back to Coke? Well, you can't get back to Coke, so they said, well, it's Coke Classic. You know, I really was going to go look up the word. I really do not know technically what the word classic means by definition in the dictionary. But I was thinking about things that are classic. Classic refers to something that's old. But not just old. It's not an antique. It has this ongoing value. So we have classical music. We talk about things that are classical. And so here's Coke. But Coke is a present product. It's not something of the past in that regard. But yet here they were looking for a definition. How do we get back to Coke and save face? And so they came out with Coke Classic. Well, John is saying this is not a new commandment in that regard. This is the classical commandment. For it would appear, as we've looked at John so far, his writings, is that there's this other group. This group that left the church. This group that says, Christ, this Jesus guy is not what you guys think he is. He's somebody different. It's not that special. He didn't come in the flesh. He's just a spirit person. And so when you look at these commands that come from Jesus, they took on another character. And so for them, they were looking at other teachings. And John is saying, this is the command you've always had. Don't get caught up in somebody saying, oh, this is something new, this is something different. This is what you've always had. It's been around as long as you've been a Christian. It's been around.
Well, the old commandment is none other than
the command that Jesus gave 60 years before. In that commandment, in 1 John 13, 34-35, he said, a new commandment I give you. Now, at that point, it was new. A new commandment I give you. Love one another as I have loved you. Now, it was new in that it had a new emphasis. It was new that it had a new direction, a new standard. The aspect of love one another wasn't new, but he says, here, it wasn't just love your neighbor. He's talking about Christians, disciples, love one another. That was a new emphasis. But the standard was, as I have loved you. And that standard would become very clear and very objective the next day when he would go to the cross. So Jesus had given this command. John picks up this idea of commands, and he writes them in a summary form, and almost is saying all of God's commands can be summarized into a single command. Look with me into the Gospel of John for a moment. The Gospel of John in chapter 15. John 15, verse 10. John 15, 10. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandment and abide in his love. And so John, citing Jesus, as John includes these words of Jesus in his gospel, everything is summarized. You can keep all of my commandments. If you keep all of my commandments, you abide in my love. If you keep my Father's commandments, you abide in his love. And then in verse 12, this is my commandment, that you love one another just as I have loved you. And then back in 1 John, in chapter 3, 1 John chapter 3 and verse 22, beloved, if our hearts, 23 is where I need to be. And this is the commandment, that we believe in the name of His Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another just as He commanded us. And then look at 2 John, 2 John, verse 6. And this is love, that we walk according to His commandments. This is the commandment, just as you have heard from the beginning, that you should walk in it. Verse 5 specifically spoke that we are to love one another. John summarized all the commandments into these single commands. Why? Because that's what Jesus had done. Just as in the Luke account where Jesus asked the man, well, how do you understand the Old Testament? Well, Jesus on another occasion in Matthew recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but in Matthew 22:37, Jesus is asked that question, what's the greatest commandment? What's the greatest commandment? Verse 36 says, teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? And Jesus said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. Every law, every command, every directive by God is dependent upon those two. Everything is derived from those two. If you understand those two, you actually don't have to know all the others. You will intuitively keep them because it's have a right relationship with God, love God, know God, and care about people.
The first was given in Deuteronomy 6:5. Heartbeat of Israel. Love the Lord your God. Hear, O Israel. These are the commands that you're to pass on to your children and your children's children. Love the Lord your God. And then in Leviticus 19:18, it says, don't hate people. Don't, you know, seek revenge. Instead, love your neighbor as yourself. So that was the heartbeat of Jesus' ministry. The minute Jesus came and he taught this kind of love. That life should be marked that like that. It's not just that Christianity is about love and God is just about love and he's just a God of love and there's nothing else. That's not what these passages are saying. But he's saying love marks the relationship. The relationship with God should be a relationship of love. The relationship with other people should be a relationship of love. But what we like to do, what they wanted to do at that time when they heard this, was to say, okay, how do I limit that? Well, John clearly understood the teaching of Jesus, and he doesn't give us any limits. Well, let's look at the next verse in 1 John 2:8. As he continues, he says, having just dogmatically stated, I'm not writing a new commandment. I'm talking about the old commandment. And then in 2:8 he says, on the other hand, I am writing a new commandment. And we're like, John, make up your mind. Which is it? I just barely got the other one figured out. Now you're saying, well, I am writing a new one. On the other hand, I am writing a new commandment to you, which is true in him and in you, because the darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. I think we could say it this way. The commandment is new because it is never out of date, since it is of the light. So John is looking here and he says, on the other hand, the commandment is new. He says, on the other hand, I am writing a new commandment. Not that it's fresh, not that it's new content, not that it's new revelation, not that you've never heard of it. It's new because it is present. It is Coke Classic. It's not something of a past age. It's right now. It's classic in that you've always had it, but it's present. It's new. Because it's not of the old age. It's of the present new age. In fact, he goes on and he says, see, it's true in Jesus. That's why it's new, because it's true in Jesus. When Jesus came, he didn't make it true, but he exemplified it. He lived it out. He brought it to a new dimension. He gave it a new clarity. It's true in him. And because the love of God resides in you, it's true in you. And that truth is brought out in Romans. That the love of God, is in your life. If you're a Christian, then God's love is resident in you. And so he says, because the darkness is passing away. The darkness, that is, the moral climate of the world we live in is passing away. That our world, it appears to us that it's normal, that it's natural, that these horrible conditions are just a part of life. But that's not the way it was. That's not the way the world was created. It seems normal to us because it's what we experience. But it, in that sense, it is the moral climate, but it's on its way out. And when light comes, the darkness will not be. But then on the other end, he's saying, actually, it's passing away, and the true light is already shining. When Jesus came, it brought in a light in another dimension, another way. But there is a day yet coming. There is a future hope of the Christian, that when the light is totally revealed, that when Christ returns, when the new age is inaugurated in that regard, that the darkness will be dispelled and the realities of God will be present.
And so the commandment is new in the sense that it's a part of what's coming. It's old in the sense that we've had it. So it depends your perspective. If you want to look to the past, oh, we've had this a long time. For us, we've had it 2,000 years. The clarity, I mean, if you go back to the Old Testament, we've had it a lot longer than that. But the clarity that Jesus brought with it, we've had for 2,000 years. It's old. But it's always new because it is a part of the age that is coming. It is presently even shining. Well, John now moves to illustrate. The commandment is illustrated. He gives us three illustrations of this commandment. The first is in verse 9, and we can put it this way. The possession of light, or the profession of light is contradicted by the possession of hate. If you profess to be of the light, if you profess to walk in the light, if you profess to reflect the light, and yet what you possess is hatred, that's a contradiction. Verse 9. The one who says he is in the light and yet hates his brother is in the darkness until now. You have to make some decisions with these passages. And I've already told you my decision-making in this is that I understand this to be about believers. It's not looking at whether you're a believer or an unbeliever. It's not looking at the unbeliever. And so in this passage, we pick up his brother, that emphasis on his brother. The one who says he's in the light and yet hates his brother. That is, that the Christian, the professing Christian that says, I hate this other Christian, actually is in the darkness. Not in the darkness in the sense that he's an unbeliever, that he's lost his salvation. But I understand that to be in the sense of the overall passage, that he's not in fellowship with the Lord. He's not walking in that close intimacy with God. That those are a contradiction. And yeah, that's a contradiction that Christians like to hold on to. That I can hate. At least I can hate selective people. At least that's where it begins. That I can hate selective people. And I can have my reasons. And my reasons are justified. Therefore, it's okay for me to hate this person and that person. Because, you see, they did this and they did that. But John says, if that's there, then there's no intimacy with God. Now, as we look at this, it's similar to last week. Surely, what's in view here is not the can a Christian become angry? Can a Christian do something that's hateful? But what's starting to characterize your life? Is it a bitterness? Is it a hatred? Have you seen those people? Have you met those people that truly are characterized as being bitter, as hating people? I mean, there's this whole group of people. Actually, there's a very small group that they do not hate. And they stand out to us. But then there's another group that is much more subtle. Their group that they hate is much smaller. They like most people. At least that's what they say. Of course, it could be that when they're with someone else, they're saying something different. And their circles may just change with who they're with, and they end up hating everyone. But John says that doesn't mark it. Now, we want to look at hate and love in very absolute terms. That is, that I hate or I love. But there's all this in between. It's kind of like a gas gauge. It's empty, it's full, and then there's all in between. It's seldom all the way empty, and it's seldom all the way full. It's usually somewhere in between. And so I look at that and I say, well, I'm not sure if I really love anybody, but I clearly don't hate anybody. But is that what love? Is that the measurement? It's all. It's either here or there or somewhere in between. Or is the standard much more like a, it's either you love or you hate. There is no in between. The Bible is much more in that regard. The Bible makes things much more difficult for us in that regard. Jesus didn't give all of these in between kinds of things. And that makes it hard for us because there probably are some mitigating things sometimes. But Jesus lays it out very clearly. Make a choice. And if love is seeking what's best for someone, not to be seeking what's best for them, perhaps, biblically, is hate. It's something to think about. How do you define hate? Is hate when you seek revenge? Is hate when you try to destroy someone? Or is hate when you withhold love? Well, the next illustration in the next verse, we could word, the possession of love keeps one from stumbling. If you possess love, if you walk in love, if love is a part of your life, if you're characterized by that love, there's a whole aspect of stumbling that will not occur in your life. In verse 10 it says, the one who loves his brother abides in the light, and there is no cause for stumbling in him. The one who loves, as Jesus says, love one another. Love each other here, to his disciples. And the world will see you're my disciples. They will observe that love. They'll know you're my disciples. Well, John says, when you do that, you walk in the light. You live in the light. Light is your domain, and you don't stumble. There's no stumbling. There's no falling. Well, then there's the third. It could be put, living in hate is equivalent to living in darkness. If you live in hate, you live in darkness. Look at verse 11. But the one who hates his brother is in the darkness. If you hate your brother, you're in the darkness. Not only that, you walk in the darkness. Your walk is controlled, is governed, is directed by the darkness. And if you've ever been walking in the darkness when it's truly dark, not when there's it's just dark outside and there's street lights and you kind of have direction or you have a flashlight, but if it's truly dark, you don't know where you're going. Because the darkness has blinded his eyes. Have you ever really been in a dark place? You have no clue. I mean, when it's really dark, not just, like I said, not just when it's dark outside and the stars are out and the moon is out or there's a street light, but when it's dark, you're not sure where anything is. You're not sure which way is which. There are these cave fish. They were primarily, I think, found in Mexico, but there's some in a cave in Kentucky. These fish live in a river in a cave. And they basically have no eyes. They have kind of the socket. But they move around by this great perception of touch and sense. But they have no eyes. For there is no need for eyes because they live in darkness. That's what we become when you hate. Look at verse 11 and think of that as a description of hating. And the one who hates his brother lives in the darkness. He walks in the darkness. He has no clue where he's going because he's blind. In the video this morning, if you were in Sunday school, there's a lady speaking on part of it. She made the statement, which I think is somewhat reflective of what Yancey has said, perhaps, that grace is not natural. that's false. See, that's not a true statement. That's a perspective from the world we live in. That's correct. From our perspective, living in a dark world, in a fallen world, in a sinful world, grace is foreign. Light is foreign. But that's not the way God created it. So, her statement is correct from our perception. But it's not theologically correct because that's not the way it's supposed to be. That's not the way it was designed. See, there's nothing more natural than love. There's nothing more natural than life. Death is what's unnatural. But because of sin, because of darkness, because of blindness, what becomes natural from our perspective is death, is hatred. John is telling us there's a test. There's a test of a relationship with God. And it has to do with love. It's not only loving God, but it's loving one another. And if hatred is what controls you, if hatred is what directs you, then actually, you can claim to have this close relationship with God, but it's not there. It's non-existent. It only exists in the imagination, in the delusion of your mind. For in reality, you're walking blindly, stumbling along, falling along in this world you've created, because that's not God's world. God's world is one of light and love. For as we'll see later in this book, God can be defined almost, and not quite defined, but a primary characteristic of God that would be stated in a very definite standpoint is God is love. God is light. God is love. Now, there are other characteristics of God. Those are in the process of understanding the Bible's as God has revealed Himself, His qualities, characteristics, those are but two of His qualities, two of His characteristics. But when God specifically chose to mention things like that, they are very necessary for us to understand how to relate to God and how to relate in this world. He is light. He is love. It has to do with truth. It has to do with darkness and light. It has to do with love and hate. God is light. God is love. As Christians, we're called to a test. Not a test to see if you go to heaven. Not a test to see if your neighbor is close to God. A test for you to ask, am I just professing, or am I relating to God in the way that He has called? That I am to love as He has loved me. Will you stand with me as we have prayer, and then we're going to have a closing hymn.